Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from Edvest and You, a loan product of the NEEF Network, a local nonprofit agency providing college student loans and student loan refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Mackie Scripps Loeb was born into a family that came to prominence in the newspaper business. But she's best known not for being part of the famous Scripps family newspaper chain, but as the spouse of William Loeb, the fiery publisher of the Union Leader. But after William Loeb died, Mackie Scripps Loeb took center stage, influencing presidents and local politicians alike. Today on the program, the life and legacy of Mackie Scripps Loeb. Did you know Mackie Scripps Loeb? Did she or the paper she published influence you in some way? Share your story with us now. Email theexchange at nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word, or give us a call now to join the conversation. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. With us now to talk about Mackie Scripps Loeb is Meg Heckman, journalist, assistant professor of journalism at Northeastern University, and author of the new biography, Political Godmother, Mackie Scripps Loeb and the Newspaper That Shook the Republican Party. Meg Heckman, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks so much for having me.
So why did you want to write about Mackie Scripps Loeb?
Well, I think like a lot of great stories, it found me. Maybe 10 years ago when I was still a reporter at the Concord Monitor and fairly early in my career, I was invited to teach a writing class at the Mackie Scripps Loeb School of Communications down in Manchester, which was a nonprofit, I think we're going to talk about it a bit later, that Mrs. Loeb founded in the final years of her life. And it offers all sorts of free classes to people from all walks of life. And I had never really taught before. And I had heard of the Union Leader. I had heard of William Loeb. I had never somehow heard of Mackie Loeb. And so I walked into this school, I taught a lovely 6-week class and immediately started picking away at Mrs. Loeb's biography. And I was absolutely astounded that someone like me, who is fascinated by political history, particularly New Hampshire political history and women's history, had never really heard of this woman and didn't fully appreciate her legacy. So down the rabbit hole I went, and I started doing archival research. I started asking around. And at first I assumed that the reason that a lot of people were not aware of Mackie Loeb was either because she wasn't in the historical record or because she hadn't really done that much. And neither of those things was true. And so that 10-year adventure is in research and reporting is now the book that we're talking about today.
So why do you think that she hasn't gotten as much attention as you think that she deserves?
I mean, I think it's twofold. One, women get written out of history all the time and for a variety of reasons. And there are a lot of us involved in women's history and feminist history that are trying to restore those aspects of the historical narrative. I think the other piece in this case was likely Mackie Loeb's personality. Almost everyone who I spoke to about her, who knew her well, described her as an introvert. And at first, I was very concerned about using that term because I think it can be a little gendered. But in this case, it really did apply. And she was a very collaborative manager. She liked to seek consensus and she liked to share credit. So I think that might have contributed to those perceptions also. And then the other factor, which I'm sure we'll talk about, is her husband, William Loeb, who has this outsized legacy in political history. He's quite a character. And I think she was never fully able to emerge from the legend of Bill Loeb.
And we'll talk a little bit about later in the program about the differences in character and personality and writing style between Naki Scripps-Loeb and William Loeb. But I want to talk a little bit more about her early life, because you spent the first part of the book talking about her origin story, her family, putting her into her context. Newspapers were the family business long before Naki Scripps married William Loeb. So tell us a little bit about her grandfather, E.W. Scripps, and how he rose to prominence.
Absolutely. So E.W. Scripps is the Scripps name in what is now Scripps Howard. And it's now a massive kind of communications conglomerate, but it had its origins as one of the first major newspaper chains in the United States. So right now, it's very commonplace for groups of newspapers to be owned by the same company, despite being in very different geographic locations. During the late 1800s, early 1900s, and around the time that E.W. Scripps was rising to prominence, that was revolutionary. So he was kind of this interesting innovator on the business side of newspapers. And by the time Naki was born in the 1920s, E.W. Scripps and Naki's father, who was in the process of taking over the business, were famous. They were these incredibly well-known, very powerful media men. They exerted tremendous influence. They both kind of had these outsized personalities. E.W. Scripps was a very odd man. Lots of biographies have been written about him. And Naki grew up mostly on this compound called Miramar in Southern California. It had horses and fleets of cars and houses for the servants and these big open porches. And she and her siblings and cousins kind of ran wild. They traveled extensively. Her mother would pack up all the kids and put them on trains to follow their father around the country for the newspaper business. So she lived this really interesting bi-coastal childhood and hated newspapers.
Absolutely hated newspapers.
Hated it.
Mm-hmm. Why? Why did she hate newspapers so much?
She just was sick of everybody talking about it. You know, I don't think she had any, disdain for the actual existence of newspapers. I just think she hated the newspaper business. And I think that's a very common, you know, coming of age story, right? Like you want to get away from what you grow up around.
She, you mentioned that she lived in on this compound in Miramar, and she was, you didn't say the word privileged, but it seems like she had a very privileged childhood. Did that shape her ideology at all?
I think it absolutely did. So her childhood was interesting. From what I was able to gather, the adults on the compound kind of left the kids alone to deal with small scale childhood squabbles. So in some ways, she grew up very independent, very good problem solver, very creative. But the tremendous wealth of the Scripps newspaper empire kept her completely insulated from any kind of material wants or needs. She had a guaranteed lifetime income through her father's estate from the time she, you know, was in her late teens, early 20s. So she was really, really insulated from a lot of the economic woes that faced people during the Great Depression. And she hated taxes. So I think that definitely contributed to at least the more financially focused aspects of her conservatism.
Listeners, we're speaking today about Naki Scripps Loeb, publisher of the Union Leader in the 1980s and 90s. She was very conservative, incredibly influential, and underrepresented in the historical record. We want to hear your thoughts on her legacy. If you have stories about her, email us now, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. One of the interesting things to know about her was that she was an illustrator and a very good one.
Yes, she was a tremendously talented artist across multiple media. And she, as a young woman, wanted to be a medical illustrator, which was a very viable career option at that time. And that's what she went to school to do. She studied art in college. But what she did after she met William Loeb and got attached to the conservative movement that was coalescing in the middle of the 20th century is she used her artistic skills to draw these very kind of intense political cartoons and editorial cartoons that would sometimes appear on the front page of the Union Leader. And in at least one case became absolutely iconic in the conservative movement.
Is that the one you're referring to about forced integration of schools?
Yes.
Can you describe that one?
Yeah, absolutely. So the cartoon that you mentioned, it's called Brotherhood by Bayonet. And Mrs. Loeb drew it in protest of forced federal integration of Little Rock High School. And this was something that the Union Leader had been editorializing against. And to accompany an editorial that William Loeb wrote, Naki Loeb drew this cartoon. It's two children, one white, one black, kind of being pushed together by soldiers. And the caption is "Love each other or else." It is a kind of troubling image, even when viewed through the lens of that time. And it certainly supports a policy that reinforces structural racism. And I was surprised to see a Northern newspaper weigh in so strongly about that issue. And what also surprised me was how widespread the republishing of that image was. I mean, to use a modern term, it went viral. I was able to find versions of that image in digital archives all across the South for decades after she drew it. It was on bumper stickers, it was on pamphlets, it was reprinted by the White Citizens Council in its publications multiple times. And it really made Naki Scripps Loeb a well-known name and a well-known figure in the early conservative movement.
Since you mentioned the White Citizens Council, we have this question from Arnie in Canterbury, who mm-hmm. asks, what was Naki Loeb's connection to the White Citizens Council and defenders of Jim Crow?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good and important question. As I was researching this book, I found a lot of troubling areas of her history and her her associations. And I think one of the most troubling was the ties that she and William Loeb had with the White Citizens Council. So the White Citizens Council was an organization that arose mostly in the South in the middle of the 20th century. And they were in favor of segregation. They were, a lot of historians describe them as polite racists. And the Union Leader aligned itself with Southern pro-segregation causes, in part because William Loeb saw it as a strategic move for the future of the Republican Party. And this was a group that Naki Loeb was in touch with right up until the early 1980s. They were republishing in their magazines and their publications profiles of her. They republished the cartoon. She was in touch with them. I don't know if she or William Loeb were formal members. I know that William Loeb spoke at one of their gatherings, and it is likely that she was there with him as his guest.
We're going to talk a little bit more about this element of their lives later in the program. Mm-hmm. But I did want to backtrack just a little bit and get you to explain how she met William Loeb.
Sure. So before Naki Loeb met William Loeb, she was married to another man. Her first husband was much older and was famous and wealthy for inventing sunscreen and among some other chemical products that were used by the Army during World War II. They eloped during the final years of the war, moved to his farm in Vermont, and it was there that she met William Loeb at a dinner party. They were both married to other people at the time. And their divorces and legal battles got absolutely international news attention. It was rather salacious. I don't delve too deeply into all of that in the book because there was just so much other stuff to get into. Mm-hmm. But they met in Vermont and she almost immediately got herself involved with William Loeb's newspaper business. He owned a couple of papers in Vermont at the time and was in the process of expanding into New Hampshire roughly around the time he met her.
So she got involved in the newspaper business before they married.
Yes.
Okay.
She was very involved.
So at some point she lost her disdain for newspapers and started to get involved somehow.
Apparently. And there's yeah. a scene in the book where she tells her mother that she's going to marry William Loeb. And her mother's response, which I guess was rather deadpan, was, well, at least it won't be boring. And it wasn't. So I was never able to find kind of her moment where she reconnected with the family newspaper business. But she definitely drew on that expertise and the family's resources. She had a long correspondence with her brothers and cousins who were running newspapers. They gave her advice and compared notes on everything from union contracts to what printing presses to buy to how to handle sending photos from the field.
I see. So she was doing some illustrating for the union leader. She was doing, seems like, some logistical stuff. To what extent was she also involved in editorials? Was she collaborating with William Loeb on his famous editorials at the time?
I think they had a lot of informal conversations about stances on issues of the day. She helped handle the mail, which was a tremendous undertaking given how vast the couple's correspondence was with all sorts of powerful people and not so powerful people all over the world. And I know she did a lot of work kind of sifting through the mail and kind of shaping some of the themes and ideas that the union leader might tackle. But from what I could tell during the bulk of their marriage, she was involved very much behind the scenes in building social connections and social capital within the conservative movement, and also helping with the nuts and bolts of the newspaper business. At the time they met, she arguably had more experience and exposure to the newspaper business than he did by virtue of her upbringing.
I see. In 1977, she and her husband were in a Jeep accident. And her injuries left her partially paralyzed and wheelchair bound. Can you talk a little bit about that accident and how it shaped her?
Yeah, absolutely. So, Naki Loeb almost died in a Jeep accident in Nevada in the late 1970s and had to survive this very grueling rehab process where she had to essentially learn how to relive her life. And in the years after she took over as publisher, after William Loeb died in the early 80s, she would often cite that experience in rehab as giving her the strength and the self-confidence to take on a newspaper and do something that she didn't think she could do and kind of exist in this very powerful world of politics and newspapers. And that said, I mean, she was very creative about living her life as a person with a disability. And I just want to note here, her eldest daughter, who's a fairly private person, very graciously went back and forth with me by email to help me understand what Mrs. Loeb's experience was like as a person with a disability. And so that's in the book.
Well, we'll talk more about Naki Scripps Loeb after a quick break. We'll talk a little bit more about what it was like to take the helm of the union leader after the death of her husband and what it was like to be a woman and a person with a disability in such a position. We're speaking with Meg Heckman, journalist and author of Political Godmother, Naki Scripps Loeb, and the newspaper that shook the Republican Party. Do you remember reading The Union Leader during the years she published it? Were you a politician she endorsed or maybe one she opposed? Call us now to tell us your story. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR or email theexchange@nhpr.org. This is The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
I don't win anything. That's not my thing.
I was shocked because I've never won anything in my life before.
I've never won anything before. That's terrific.
No one ever thinks they're going to win an HPR summer raffle until they do. And this year could be your year. Three early bird winners can choose between $2,000 in gas gift cards or EV charging. And our grand prize winner can choose between $25,000 toward a new car or $20,000 in cash. Get your raffle tickets right now at nhpr.org.
Right now, we're speaking about Naki Scripps Loeb, conservative, publisher of The Union Leader, influencer of public opinion, both here in New Hampshire and beyond. Meg Heckman is with us. She's the author of Political Godmother, Naki Scripps Loeb, and the newspaper that shook the Republican Party. Share your memories of Naki Scripps Loeb. 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. Meg Heckman, in 1981, William Loeb died, and Naki became the publisher of The Union Leader. She joined the ranks of publishing at a time when very few women were leading newspapers. Can you tell us a little bit about what it was like to be a woman and a person with a disability in such a position at that time?
Absolutely. The ableism and the sexism in the narratives around Naki Loeb's rise to publisher and president of the Union Leader Corporation were shocking and appalling, even for 1981. It was just awful. There were people that said, you know, the Union Leader would never exert any power in national politics again, that it would not exert any power in local politics again, that Naki Loeb was a figurehead, that she couldn't possibly run a company, someone that used a wheelchair simply could not handle such a high profile position, that she was too meek, she was too mild, all of these very gendered terms. And, you know, she kind of quietly proved everyone wrong. And it's interesting to note that the farther removed from Naki Loeb's inner circle the writers were, the more likely they were to say these things. Most of the people that knew Naki Loeb and were working for her, or liked what she and William Loeb had to say, or hated what she and William Loeb had to say, knew perfectly well that she was going to be a very capable manager, but she really had to push back against these narratives. And she did that in all sorts of interesting ways. She went out and talked to community groups. She gave national interviews, and as the 1984 primary drew near, she attached herself to C-SPAN, which was rising in popularity, and she became this regular commenter on C-SPAN, and that got her this national fan base that she then leveraged into power in the conservative movement later in her career.
I want to go to the phones for the moment and talk to Corin in Hopkinton. Corin, you're Naki Loeb's granddaughter.
Yep, Corinne, yes.
Corinne, oh, I apologize for mispronouncing your name. Thank you for calling. What's your story?
I grew up with my grandmother in-house. Like, we grew up, because of her disability, we grew up taking care of her. And, you know, she was a very cool grandmother, and she always pushed us, especially me being the granddaughter, as women to, you know, do what you can, and you can do anything, and school is important and everything. And she always had a great story. We always had a great story, which was that she every year supported the Miss New Hampshire pageant, and every year it was a big deal that she took me, and it was a big deal to get the dress and go, and we got to, you know, it was our special thing that we did every year.
We were just talking briefly about her time taking the helm of the Union Leader. Did she ever talk to you about what it was like to take over the business after your grandfather died?
Yeah, I mean, she talked a little bit about it. More so, I read her editorials. I went back when I was a little bit older, and because she passed away when I was a freshman in high school, which at the time I kind of didn't realize how big of a deal that was. Her funeral was on C-SPAN, actually, and I didn't realize at the time how big this was. And I went back and read some of her editorials, and a lot of her editorials were stories of our family. Funny, you know, or stories that she had written in the paper about, you know, our dogs or our a birth of, you know, my birth was one of them, was an editorial, and my brother, and just different ways of editorials were actually part of our family, which was really cool.
That's fascinating. Meg Heckman, I don't know if you have questions for her or if you've already been in touch in the writing of this book, but I'd love to give you the opportunity to chat.
Sure. I'm so glad that you called in, because so many of those more personal and local anecdotes, you know, they're not in the book for a couple reasons. One, I was very mindful, you know, you and I are roughly the same age, and I was very mindful mm-hmm. that the extended family is private. And, you know, I was trying to deal mm-hmm. with her public
very
legacy
much.
While respecting that. I'm incredibly grateful, like I said before, to your aunt for sharing what she shared with me, particularly about your grandma's experience as a person with a disability. And there's a lot of things about her involvement in the local community that are not in the book, because I was writing it for a national audience.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it would have been, and I often found myself wondering, you know, as somebody who is also from New Hampshire and worked in local news, how different a story it would have been, no less true, no less accurate, but how different a story it would have been if I'd been writing it just for a New Hampshire audience. But thank you so much for calling in and sharing those memories.
Corinne, last, go ahead.
Interesting stories. There's definitely interesting stories. I can remember I was in high school and I was in a history class, and part of the history class was, William Loeb was in the history book. And I was like, oh, that was my grandfather. It was kind of a little odd to be in history class and find out about your grandfather, but it was, yeah.
Not every day you can say you've seen your grandparents in a history book. Well, Corinne, thank you very much for calling in and sharing your insights. It's great
to hear
from you.
Thank you.
Listeners, we're speaking today about Naki Scripps Loeb. If you've got stories about her, as her granddaughter did, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Joining us on the line now is Democratic Senator Lou D'Alessandro. Thank you very much for joining the program today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So you're a veteran of state politics. What was the landscape when you were getting involved? Was Naki Loeb running the union leader at the time?
Oh, she was running the union leader, but when I got involved, William Loeb was running the union leader. And Meg, you must have looked at the cast of characters that surrounded her when she married William Loeb. You had McQuaid, who played golf with my father-in-law, who was a trip. You had William Loeb. You had the great Jim Finnegan, who was the editorial writer, who was smashing me 24/7. And the characters that were on the staff of the Manchester Union Leader, and certainly my contact with Mrs. Loeb, the paper. Obviously, has written many editorials against me, many cartoons against me, and throughout my political career, had occasion to meet Mrs. Loeb three times in my life, twice before the accident, and once in the office, in her office, at the paper, when she had taken over as the publisher of the Union Leader. It was a very interesting meeting. She was in her wheelchair. She was with Joe McQuaid, who they were grooming to take over, and he eventually did. But I think she was a very tough lady. and a very tough lady, but came across as a very nice lady. As a matter of fact, if you were in her presence, you would have questioned some of the writings that came forth.
Meaning there was a contrast between how nice the person was in front of you and how
stark,
the tone of the articles.
Stark difference, yeah. Mm-hmm. She was a good conversationalist, very receptive to what I had to say, and very congenial, to be honest with you. Very, very congenial. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask you if you while you were running for office, found what she and others at the union leader she ran was fair to you. It may have been something you disagreed with, but did you find it fair?
I don't think the editorials against me were fair. No, I never found them to be fair.
In what ways were they unfair?
First of all, describing me as liberal Lou, that I think was, because I was never, I guess compared to them, I was liberal, but the tag, a liberal Lou, and the one I can remember one lovely cartoon where someone was throwing a hat at me and severed my head. I thought that was a bit much.
Oof, yeah, that doesn't sound great. Meg, are you sorry for the visceral reaction? Meg, are you familiar with that cartoon? Did you encounter that in your research?
I am not, and I don't believe that. Senator, do you recall, was that one that Mrs. Loeb drew, or was that one that the staff cartoonist drew?
I don't think she drew it. I think Dobbins, okay. You know, they had a number of cartoonists, mm-hmm. and Dobbins was probably the toughest one to deal with. That's when the paper was really, really after me. But I was very surprised to, and I did a little background on this, that she had written 1,600 editorials, about 1,600 editorials during that time. If you were the victim of a William Loeb editorial, you got a front page editorial, and I got a front page editorial, and I must say I shared that with Dopey Dwight, Jerry the Jerk, who was these were two presidents of the United States. She wasn't that vitriolic, in my opinion, but she was very much to the right. I don't think you could argue with that analysis. She was very much to the right.
And
I think she had to be a tough lady. First of all, the accident. I saw her before the accident, and I saw her after the accident. Did you meet with her, Meg?
With Mrs. Loeb, no. She had, she died when I was still in high school. So unfortunately, no. I do have a vague memory of touring the old Union Leader building in the fourth grade, but I have no idea if she was there or not.
Okay. Well, I met her in her office in the Union Leader building after the accident. And believe it or not, my wife and I were at the granddaughter talked about the Miss New Hampshire pageant. We were at the Miss New Hampshire pageant when we sat right behind Mr. and Mrs. Loeb, and he had written a front page editorial against me that day it appeared in the paper, and neither one of them would look at me or my wife. It was really talk about a frigid zone. But after that, when I met with her, after he had passed away, and I met with her in her office, or the office in the Union Leader, and the Union Leader building was something. It's now the Manchester District Court. But I said she was very civil, and our conversation was about politics, and obviously we differed. We differed on political opinions, but she was. She was receptive to the conversation. I can say that, and I think she did a lot for people with disabilities. I had a very close friend who was in an auto accident, who became a wheelchair bound, and I know she did a lot in that farm in Goffstown, where I think they provided riding for for people. So she was active in that area too. But she carried on that newspaper in very much the same way that it had been constructed prior to that, very conservative, and was a player. There's no question she was a player.
Senator D'Alessandro, we have to let you go. We've got a bunch of calls to bring into the conversation,
sure.
But I do appreciate you sharing your insight. Thank you very much for being on the program today.
Oh, my pleasure. And I'm going to buy the book, Meg. How's that? Thank you.
That's
very
great.
Much.
Thank you so much, Senator.
All right. Take care and have a great, great, great American Day.
Thank you.
Listeners, this is The Exchange. We're speaking today about Naki Scripps Loeb, the publisher of The Union Leader in the 80s and 90s, her life and legacy. You can call with your stories and insights, 1-800-892-6477, or email exchange@nhpr.org. Meg Heckman, Senator D'Alessandro mentioned just a moment ago that Naki Scripps Loeb, being a person with a disability, did a lot for people with disabilities. We get this note from Peter in Londonderry. Did Naki oppose the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, despite her disability?
She did. She was vocally opposed to it. And that was one of the most interesting case studies of her political ideology. You know, she did a lot of work at the local level to raise the profile of people with disabilities. In the early 80s and into the 90s, you know, she was out speaking to community groups, just, you know, by nature of this person in a powerful position, in a wheelchair, having her picture taken and appearing on C-SPAN. You know, she did a lot, both subtly and overtly, to normalize the existence of people with disabilities kind of in the public sphere. She advocated locally for accessible trails, most of it privately funded. She advocated a lot for local business groups to hire people with disabilities, encouraged her editors at the Union Leader to feature stories about people with disabilities working out in the community. But her advocacy came to a hard stop when conversations about government involvement, particularly federal government involvement, came up, and she editorialized against the ADA.
We have a few calls we'd like to bring into the conversation. Let's talk to Don in Nashua. Don, thank you very much for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for having me on. I have read the book. I grew up in Manchester. I met Naki Loeb as a student journalist at one point in time. I want to say I'm sure she was a very nice person, but the sum total of her public impact, I think, was decidedly negative. The author talked about troubling ties to the White Citizens Council. That was manifested as bigotry in the pages of the Union Leader. And I would also say that I know that in reading the book, you tried to separate her legacy and William Loeb's legacy. He destroyed lives with his editorials and his shoddy journalism. And she benefited from that. The beautiful house in Reno, the house in Pride's Crossing. And if she was a partner with him answering all the letters, she bears some responsibility for his legacy as well. And I'm wondering if you could talk. I don't know if you have the book in front of you. She wrote at a point in time when gay rights were a particularly pressing public issue. I think she wrote a letter supporting to Gordon Humphrey in which is just dripping with bigotry for members of the gay community. And I appreciate what Lou D'Alessandro said, and I don't think this discussion is appropriate without people weighing in with a counterweight to, you know, she was a good artist and a doting grandmother and a nice person. Her public legacy is a really, really bad one.
Well, Don, thank you for the call, and I think I have a passage here from Meg's book that's relevant to what you're describing with respect to her views on homosexuality. Meg, you write here that's in an interview with the Boston Globe, Naki described her decision on this by saying, "I don't like hatred, but at the same time, I think some things in the world should be hated because of their corrupting influence. She wrote, "I think we should hate those things which are degrading and repulsive and bring down the moral basis on which this country is founded. Acceptance of homosexuality as being correct and morally proper is one of those things." That is very hard to hear, Meg.
Yeah, it is. And I want to be 100% clear. Naki Loeb was on the wrong side of history. She was wrong about that. She was wrong about school desegregation, and she was wrong about LGBTQ rights. And I found those parts of her legacy and some other parts too incredibly troubling. And they are, however, an example of the role that white women, most of them upper middle class and above, have played in the construction of the modern conservative movement, and the conservative movement over the last 50 or 60 years. And you know, we see this in pop culture right now. If anybody's been watching Mrs. America on Hulu, you know, Phyllis Schlafly is a major character, and the role of white women in reinforcing conservative social norms and supporting policies that reinforce structural racism, structural sexism, and marginalize entire communities. So her legacy is incredibly problematic in those areas. It's still important that we document it and understand it, so we as a society can have a fuller and more complete understanding of the ways that women have been involved in politics and civic life across the ideological spectrum.
We're speaking today with Meg Heckman, journalist and author of the new biography, Political Godmother, Naki Scripps Loeb, and the newspaper that shook the Republican Party. We haven't talked much about her role in influencing politics here in the First in the Nation primary state, but we will after a break. If you've got insights into that particular aspect of her professional career, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. This is The Exchange. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and today we're speaking with Meg Heckman, journalist and author of the new biography, Political Godmother, Naki Scripps Loeb, in the newspaper that shook the Republican Party. Listeners, if you've got stories of Naki Scripps Loeb, let us hear them. Our number is 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange@nhpr.org. We'll get back with Meg Heckman in just a moment, but joining us now is Gregory Sullivan. His firm served as general counsel for the Union Leader Corporation for the past 34 years. He's also an instructor at the Naki S. Loeb School of Communications. Gregory Sullivan, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So what's your predominant memory of Naki Loeb?
That's predominant is an interesting word.
Maybe a broad question. You may have many memories of her.
That is the truth. Yeah. You know, I served as her personal counsel as well as counsel to the union leader. And it was actually 60 years ago that my firm began as general counsel to Union Leader Corporation before my time. But for the past 43 years, I'd say I served as counsel to the corporation and obviously to Mrs. Loeb until she passed. But my thoughts that haven't been talked about today was her devotion, number one, to America and particularly to the First Amendment, and her school that she founded in Manchester was dedicated to educating the citizens of New Hampshire and the United States about communications, journalism, and again, particularly the importance of the First Amendment.
And so her legacy primarily, you think, is her school, the Naki S. Loeb School of Communications? Or does it go beyond
that? I do.
Okay.
I do. In fact, she felt so strongly about the importance of the school and the importance of independent newspapers. She left her stock, which was majority ownership of Union Leader Corporation, to the school, which now is the majority shareholder of Union Leader Corporation.
Mm-hmm. And what is that business decision sort of representative of? It seems like it places a sort of flag in the local control area of newspapers. She didn't really want it to be owned by a big corporation out of state. She wanted it to stay in New Hampshire. And it seems like that business decision is representative of that.
That's exactly correct. We used to call it the Pac-Man syndrome, where the bigger newspapers and communications chains were just gobbling up newspapers across the country. You know, the New York Times buying the Boston Globe is a significant example. And yes, she wanted the union leader to remain independent and owned by citizens of New Hampshire.
Well, Gregory Sullivan, general counsel for the union leader and instructor at the Naki S. Loeb School of Communications, thanks for speaking with us. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Listeners, we're talking about Naki Scripps Loeb today. Still some time to get your questions or comments in if you have them. 1-800-892-6477. Meg Heckman, before the break, we were speaking a little bit about her influence in politics, but we didn't get too deep into her First in the Nation primary politicking. Mm-hmm. And one giant example you point out here in this book is her support of the candidacy of Pat Buchanan. Can you talk a little bit about that and what that meant for her politics?
Yes, absolutely. So one of the things that was most interesting in my research into Naki's private papers was the extent of her analog social network, and how vast it was and how deep it reached into the very, very rightmost wings of the conservative movement. And reading her letters during the 70s, 80s, and 90s was a lot like reading an analog subreddit about right-wing politics. And she was able to connect people, both the powerful and the not so powerful, across geography in this really powerful way. And when she became displeased with the Bush administration and what she viewed as the Republican Party's embrace of moderate policies and kind of a moderate evolution, she used that powerful analog social network to support Pat Buchanan, who at the time was a fairly well-known conservative commentator, support him in challenging George H.W. Bush in the 1992 New Hampshire primary. Now, Buchanan did not win. He came very close to beating Bush in New Hampshire. And so he really won the news cycle, but he did not win the primary, not in New Hampshire, not nationally. But it was enough to get him to the Republican National Convention in 1992, where he gave what is often referred to as the culture war speech. The conservatives loved it. Moderates were shocked by how vicious and divisive it was. And there are a lot of people that point to that as one of the key moments in the rise of what's often called the resurgence of the religious right during the 1990s.
One of the things that
we can certainly see echoes of that influence in today's conservative landscape too.
I was just going to say, because one of the things that stood out here was that Pat Buchanan at the time had an America First policy that Naki Scripps Loeb liked so much that she had an America First bumper sticker on her wheelchair.
Yes. So I talked, one of the first interviews I did for this book was with Pat Buchanan. You know, I was in his living room outside of DC for a few hours, and he was very clear that like Donald Trump didn't call him to download his thoughts on political ideology, but there are definitely parallels. That said, they are two very different men, and they ran campaigns in very different times. So I don't know how much we can learn from one campaign cycle about the moment that we're in right now, but I do think that it points to the power and the endurance of a certain corner of the electorate.
We get this note from Ginger, who writes, "I worked for the weekly newspapers produced under the union leader umbrella from 1994 to 2014. Naki was a huge supporter of the local weeklies, as was her daughter, Naki Scagliotti. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right.
I think it's Scagliotti.
Scagliotti. Naki Scagliotti was her daughter. Ginger continues, my understanding is that the Naki Loeb School of Communications was begun at least in part as a nonprofit entity to protect the newspapers from being swallowed up by large chains. I don't know either of them very well, but did visit Naki Senior's home in Goffstown a few times and took part in the Upreach Therapeutic Riding Center's fundraisers. She did a lot of good there. Can you tell us anything about that, the Upreach Therapeutic Riding Center?
Yeah, absolutely. What I can tell you is that the farm that Naki and her extended family lived on for most of her time at running the Union Leader is now a nonprofit therapeutic riding center that supports people with a lot of different types of disabilities. Naki, before her accident, was an incredibly accomplished horsewoman, and I think as was her younger daughter. And so I think that that is reflected in that. Beyond the fact that it still exists and does a lot of good things in the community, I don't know a lot about it, but I think that is an example of just how multifaceted her legacy is. You know, like I said earlier in the hour, this book was written for a national audience and kind of pondered her role in the national conservative movement. But on the local level, she is remembered for a lot of different things. And I think that's reflective in the people that we're hearing from today.
You comment on her conservative legacy by saying, and I'm going to paraphrase here, that she didn't invent the conservative ideology, but she did play a role in preserving those principles, which she found appealing in Ronald Reagan, for the next generation that was ready to hear it. So in your view, Meg Heckman, is that message still preserved? Is it still waiting to be heard, or is it being heard right now?
I mean, I think that we can certainly hear echoes of the rhetoric that Naki Loeb used and repeated in today's political environment. That said, I have no idea what she would think of the Trump presidency. I have no idea what she would think of the modern political moment that we're in. And in fact, as I was writing the book, I often thought if I could have one question with her, that would be it. Just what do you think of right now? I do think it was interesting that she viewed herself as very much playing a long game. She viewed Pat Buchanan's candidacy not so much as a bid for the White House, but a bid for the hearts and minds of young political activists on the right.
Let's take a quick phone call from Pauline in Sanborn. Pauline, thank you very much for calling. What's on your mind?
Oh, well, I was a kid living in Wilton, New Hampshire in the late 50s, 1960, and the Union Leader had a contest for paper route carriers, and I won the contest because it involved a trip to Switzerland, and I was a skier, so I really wanted to go. Anyhow, I basically sold the Union Leader to the entire town. The guy that ran the newspaper stand told me that I was cutting into his business, his newspaper business. Anyway, but after I won, Meg Garrity, who was the woman's editor at the time, and myself went to visit the Loebs in Pride's Crossing, and at that time, his oldest daughter was the same age I was, 14 years old. So I basically met the family, and I was really surprised at William Loeb's sort of British accent, but I just felt they were very hospitable to myself and my family, and they actually ran all these stories about paper girl wins paper boy contest and all this stuff. And, you know, I still have a letter from William and Naki Loeb congratulating me for winning. My politics are totally opposite of theirs, but on the human side, I feel that Naki Loeb, you know, was a remarkable person.
Well, Pauline, we got to let you go, but thank you very much for sharing your thoughts. I appreciate that. Last quick question to you, Meg Heckman. Who's the Naki Loeb of today? Who's the female conservative, either newspaper publisher or genuine thought leader for the right? Who's carrying the Naki Loeb torch?
Gosh.
Tough question maybe for the last few seconds. But
I don't think there is any one person. I think there are a number of publications kind of in the right wing media ecosystem that have a lot of regular female voices. The Federalist comes up as I think about this. That's a publication that has a lot of female writers, commentators, dealing with a lot of the issues that Naki Loeb was dealing with in her editorials. And I often found myself thinking that, if Naki Loeb were alive today, perhaps that publication would be reprinting her editorials, or maybe she would have founded a publication like that of her own, because she was incredibly innovative and was always looking for new audiences.
Well,
I think the point that Pauline made was a good one. The Union Leader was a political organ, but it was also a lot of people's kind of beloved local paper. And I think that's important to remember too.
Meg Heckman, journalist and author of the new biography, Political Godmother, Naki Scripps Loeb and the Newspaper That Shook the Republican Party. Thank you very much for speaking with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today, but the conversation continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The show's producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Michael Brindley is our program manager. Jane Vaughn is the production fellow for The Exchange, and our regular theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.